Newly declassified documents show that early in the 1994 mass slaughter in Rwanda, U.S. officials were well aware of what was taking place and chose not to intervene. 800,000 Rwandans were massacred in just 100 days. The victims of the genocide were ethnic Tutsis, the minority group in the country, and moderate Hutus. Human rights scholar Samantha Power spent the past 3 years interviewing U.S. officials and going over the newly declassified records. In an article in the September issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Power asks why the United States let the Rwanda tragedy happen. She says that 7 years ago, following the plane crash that killed the Rwandan president in early April, U.S. officials had plenty of notice about the scale of the slaughter to come. The warnings began almost instantly from embassy staff in Rwanda.
The United States had an embassy, of course, in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. These officials reported back daily, indeed hourly, in the first 3 days of the killings. And then they returned to Washington and in person told anybody who would heed them that, in fact, there was systematic targeting of ethnic Tutsi going on. The other thing that must be said is that this genocide was reported as well in the New York Times and the Washington Post every day. Within a week of the genocide, the estimates were as high as 20,000 in the New York Times. Within 2 weeks of the genocide, the major papers and the major media were reporting Red Cross estimates of 100,000 dead. Now, these numbers proved actually low estimates. In fact, many more were dead at that time. But still, if we're talking already in the scale of tens of thousands of dead, you would have thought that this kind of killing scale would have attracted the attention of senior Washington policymakers.
In fact, you had access to papers from the Pentagon and the State Department at the time in which people are discussing whether this should be called genocide, what became known as the G word.
Indeed. That debate began about just after 2 weeks, and it took place in the legal advisor's office, it took place at the White House, it took place throughout the bureaucracy, both in a kind of casual form, you know, well, what do you think? Is it genocide? Does it look like that which we said we wouldn't let happen again? And it also took place in legal circles because there was some speculation that the Genocide Convention, the 1948 UN treaty banning genocide, obliged military intervention if there was a legal finding of genocide. This is, in fact, not true. The Genocide Convention obliged steps undertaken to prevent and to punish genocide. It didn't actually oblige outright military intervention. But I think the real fear was, if you call it a genocide and then do nothing about it, how do you overcome your own moral dissonance and the kind of political dissonance? There was a real fear of spiking public pressure for intervention and public concern for what was going on in Rwanda. That concern did not exist, and they were afraid that calling it genocide would only attract attention to the problem.
One factor that was at play was that the crisis in Rwanda broke out just 6 months after another tragedy, which was the killing of 18 U.S. soldiers in Somalia. And then in Rwanda, you had 10 Belgian peacekeepers who were murdered. Didn't policymakers have very good reason to be leery of involvement, given what experience they had had?
For starters, the U.S. Congress was incredibly squeamish about not merely sending U.S. troops into peacekeeping missions, but even funding U.N. missions that were undertaken by troops from other nations. And this very much colored the Clinton administration's perception of what it could do during the genocide. Secondly, at the Pentagon, there was a terrible fear that if you just deployed your assets to try to jam Rwandan hate radio, or if you did any one of a number of things along a kind of soft continuum of intervention, shy of U.S. military intervention, if you dipped the toe in, the entire body would get submerged. And that was a lesson from Somalia, is that there was no such thing as a small intervention, because what began as a small intervention would inevitably end large and messy. And there was a real skepticism also that the Clinton White House would stand behind a Pentagon that got into trouble in a humanitarian mission.
Given this climate that we're talking about, what would you have had the United States do? Is there anything short of full military intervention that could have prevented any of this violence?
Well, I think, for starters, the United States should have given this high-level attention. This was the fastest killing spree of the 20th century. Faster even than the Holocaust, and it did not warrant in 100 days of genocide even a cabinet-level meeting at the White House. Each day, Rwandan genocidaires were looking left and right to see who was paying attention, and all that they heard out of Washington was silence. The other thing the United States could have done is it could have had, or lobbied to have, the Rwandan ambassador to the United Nations expelled. He was the representative of the genocidal government. And I think most significantly, the United States could have used the tremendous leverage it had at the Security Council and with its allies to rally troops from other nations. And it had the political capacity to use its leverage to inspire countries around the world. Instead, what it did in New York is it demanded a UN withdrawal, stranding not only the Rwandans, but even the UN commander, Romeo Dallaire, on the ground in Rwanda. And it then blocked the subsequent authorization of UN reinforcements. And that went on for 2 months, well after it was known that more than 100,000 people had been killed, and when it was very clear that all Tutsi in Rwanda were vulnerable.
You went back and interviewed dozens of policymakers on this question, asking them to sort of explain what had happened. And I was struck by the comment from George Moose at the State Department, who said, "We were psychologically and imaginatively too limited." What did he mean by that?
Well, I think that it takes a peculiar mind to be able to imagine genocide. Most of the U.S. diplomats involved in the Arusha peace process who paid attention to Rwanda over the years had dealt with the very people who summoned the genocide. And I think George Moose was one of many who expected some violence in Rwanda, or who had, you know, feared violence, shall we say, in Rwanda. But could he have possibly wrapped his mind around the idea that Rwandan ordinary people would pick up machetes and garden implements and grenades and join the Rwandan militia in systematically tracking down every Tutsi in their midst? No, he couldn't have imagined it. And I'm not sure we would like ourselves to be able to imagine, if you know what I mean. And if we were the kind of people who could just imagine that tomorrow that kind of thing would convulse a society, we'd be pretty cynical indeed. Unfortunately, these are the kinds of killing sprees that have marred the 20th century and will mar the 21st, and we have to learn to imagine.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Samantha Power is Executive Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University. Her article, Bystanders to Genocide, is in the September issue of The Atlantic Monthly. To hear more of our interview with Samantha Power, go to our website, npr.org.